From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, how lessons from Flint, Michigan and Washington, D.C. can help Milwaukee solve its lead contamination crisis.
Then the work of San Francisco pediatrician Nadine Burke-Harris was set into motion when she noticed a curious pattern.
What I observed was this trend that my patients who often had the worst outcomes were also the ones who had some pretty significant exposures to adversity. And I wanted to understand the science behind that pattern.
And why writer and Milwaukee native Dan Coyce had no trouble getting people to talk about the making of the play Angels in America 25 years ago.
People were hungry to tell these stories because the play and the experience of creating it or having a hand in creating it so defined their lives and careers for decades to come.
Lake Effect is next. First, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Earlier this week, we learned about 16th Street Community Health Center's public education efforts in the face of a continuing lead contamination crisis in Milwaukee. The city's health department has been in turmoil after revelations that it failed to follow up with residents whose home water supplies were found to have significant lead contamination issues.
It sounds like a bleak situation, but Yana Lambrinidou believes there is still hope for redemption in Milwaukee's response. Lambrinidou was a member of the Virginia Tech University team that uncovered the lead crisis in Flint, Michigan, and before that, in Washington, D.C.
She spoke in Milwaukee last week on policy solutions for Milwaukee's lead problems. First, she sat down in the offices of the Spanish Journal newspaper and talked about the message she wanted to get across with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz.
The work that is happening in Milwaukee is really at the forefront of the work that I'm involved in nationally in trying to address lead in drinking water. And Milwaukee has, I would say, the strongest and most effective coalition that is also achieving quite extraordinary change in how lead in drinking water is addressed and how it's being talked about.
So what are the changes you're hearing about?
I think that the real big change that's unique so far in this country is the transparency resolution that is really changing the way in which people are supported to think about lead in water and encouraging people to really see it as something that's prevalent, that would necessitate for protection the installation of filters. These are things that are not heard and certainly not officially sanctioned in other cities because the mantra, if you will, on lead in drinking water is that if your water utility meets federal standards, you have nothing to worry about. Your water is safe. Milwaukee now has moved beyond that myth in really letting people know that if you have lead-bearing plumbing, then you are at risk of exposure to lead in water. And this is really groundbreaking, amazingly, for 2018, that we're still just trying to uncover the basic facts about lead in water. But Milwaukee is really the national leader in achieving that. And I wanted to support this work. I believe very deeply in having worked on this issue for over a decade that I have not seen change happen locally without it being driven by activists on the ground, not on this issue. And Milwaukee is our hope nationally because it's showing us the way, not only that it can be done, but also in what is required for this to be done well. And what is happening here is that there's a diverse coalition of people on the ground, grassroots groups and nonprofit organizations and academics and people with different expertise and different networks and resources coming together to address this problem in a united way. And I think that's something that is rare and that is bearing fruit, and we're seeing it.
So, of course, you know the recent history of your colleague, Mark Edwards, having been here. our mayor at that point declaring families of young children should have filters. And then there have been all sorts of complications and difficulties, miscommunications, a health department which is at a minimum in turmoil or more. So all of that aside, you see Milwaukee as moving forward.
I do see Milwaukee as moving forward. First of all, the resolution, the transparency resolution, did pass. And I also think that it's going to be pretty impossible to shift paradigms in our thought and in our practice without this type of upset in our government agencies and this type of resistance that we're seeing. I think what the community is asking for in Milwaukee is really a paradigm shift, is asking for a different way to think about lead in drinking water, to communicate about lead in drinking water, to address it, to fund it. And so these changes that are systemic, they're institutional changes, do not happen with just a signing a piece of paper. And there are going to be people who are wedded to a paradigm that is not only ineffective, but is scientifically unsupported, and have built their careers within that paradigm. There's going to be resistance to the change. And I think that this resistance is only a healthy sign of cleansing, if you will, and shedding an old skin and an old way of thinking and moving into a new one. I think it's part and parcel of change.
The conversation this evening will be health impacts and policy solutions for Milwaukee's lead crisis. So what do you feel a key bit of your message will be this evening?
You know, I think that lead in drinking water is one of those contaminants that is addressed right now by the lead and copper rule, which is a regulation that renders residents and consumers partly responsible for protecting themselves from exposures. The lead and copper rule is a unique regulation in that, unlike almost every other drinking water regulation, does not require water utilities to ensure that there is no trace of the contaminant in the water when the water reaches people's taps. This is a regulation that allows for a lot of lead in drinking water, in fact, even when lead and copper rule standards are met. And so I think that policy solutions that are effective are going to need activists and residents and people on the ground who feel that the conditions are there for them to be working together with the government here to develop these solutions collaboratively. And right now, it's quite clear that the government is going to need to respond to demands that have not yet been met, so that the conditions hopefully can be created for residents and government officials to come together and create solutions together. Lead in drinking water is a complicated problem, and it does require respect and collaboration and support of residents to protect themselves. And I think it also requires a paradigm shift in how we think about it, and the residents here are driving it. I think my main message tonight is going to be that resident activism is as necessary for arriving at effective solutions and just solutions as corrosion control treatment. The lead and copper rule is a regulation that is fixated on corrosion control treatment because it comes from an engineering mindset. We add this chemical and then we're done. And unfortunately, lead in water is not responding to that solution quite well. And unless there are relationships and trust and mutual respect and understanding that in this city, and in fact all across the country, it's the residents who are actually educating the officials about how lead in water works and what the locally appropriate and just solutions are going to be. Unless these voices are heard and there's willingness and the conditions to work together, solutions are going to be hard to develop.
Just so that I understand this, not only is the lead and copper rule supposed to be updated, right, so that there's less lead that's considered to be okay in the water mains and the laterals, there happens to be an issue with lead within the home that is something the city might say, does say. It's unfortunate, but that's your lead.
Yeah, this is a very important question. The lead and copper rule is a regulation that was created to meet Safe Drinking Water Act requirements. The Safe Drinking Water Act requires EPA to develop standards and regulate water for contaminants that are known to cause adverse health effects. And the Safe Drinking Water Act, it's quite clear, was created to protect individuals from consuming water that might make them sick. So the lead and copper rule, in fact, requires water utilities to take certain measures so that the water that comes out of people's taps has very low to no lead. The lead and copper rule is, again, very unique in that way, in that it regulates water that comes out of the tap, not water that comes out of a treatment plant or just the water that reaches the lead lateral. Water utilities, the reason they sample for lead and copper rule compliance at people's homes is because they are mandated to do so. And they need to make sure through the sampling that lead in water levels in people's homes are low enough. And I say this quote unquote, mm-hmm. there's low, you know, really the only safe level of lead in water is zero. And so water utilities are absolutely responsible for the levels of lead that come out of people's taps inside their homes. However, water utilities have also, from the very beginning of the lead and copper rule back in 1991, resisted fiercely this notion that this rule, the lead and copper rule, would make them responsible for any plumbing inside people's homes. And the water utility industry has created this artificial division between public and private plumbing, and they have done it so successfully that this myth has been born that the lead and copper rule requires water utilities to deliver quote-unquote safe water only up to the publicly owned plumbing, and from there on, everybody's on their own to fend for themselves. That is a myth, and that is not at all what the lead and copper rule says, and it's also, of course, not what the Safe Drinking Water Act ever intended. I do want to add, though, that yes, homeowners do own the private part of the plumbing inside their home. And in many cities, they own the lead lateral, the part that goes through private space. That is true. But I don't think that ownership of plumbing goes as far as to say that, therefore, the water utility is not responsible for the lead that is coming out of those plumbing materials. And I say this, first of all, because that's what the lead and copper rule says, but also that plumbing materials, whether they're owned by a homeowner or the water utility, plumbing materials release lead when the water is corrosive enough to make the lead come out of plumbing. And so there's always that interaction between the chemistry of the water and how the plumbing reacts. To take away that relationship and pretend that private plumbing just releases lead all on its own just oversimplifies the science of lead in drinking water. And the other thing also to say is that you know, in contrast to laws that we have passed for lead in paint and lead in gasoline, when it comes to lead in plumbing, we are still adding lead into our brand new fixtures. And not only that, our law allows for the introduction of lead into new plumbing fixtures, but also our law allows for plumbing manufacturers to slap onto these fixtures the label lead-free. Lead-free plumbing today, what is sold to us as lead-free plumbing, is allowed by law to have a certain amount of lead in it. And even though that amount has been reduced significantly since early 2014, the new definition of lead-free took effect. But still, the brand new fixtures that are out in the market and we are buying and thinking we are all lead-free can actually still cause severe contamination. And we've seen this from sampling that has been done in Flint, Michigan schools that replaced all of their fixtures. And they did see a dramatic decrease in lead in water levels. And that's really fantastic news, but they continue to see high lead levels at some taps, sometimes in the hundreds and even thousands parts per billion. So I think that as much as I think our government agencies and industries are a little bit in the habit of blaming consumers for lead in their water, and that has been going on for a little while. I think that that blaming is really not supported by the facts, because in fact, it's the plumbing manufacturers and the water utility industry, together with EPA, that have continued to allow in the 21st century, 2018, for our plumbing to still not be zero lead, and also have allowed this travesty of the label lead-free to actually not mean zero lead, but mean a little bit of lead that can still harm your child. And I think that this is really where we need grassroots activism and the types of powerful networks as the one that has been developed in Milwaukee to demand common sense and morally sound solutions. This is not going to come from above.
Yana Lambrinidou was a member of the team at Virginia Tech University that uncovered the Flint, Michigan lead contamination crisis, and before that, the crisis in Washington, D.C. She spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz before an event in Milwaukee last week. You can find much more of our coverage of Milwaukee's lead contamination problem at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, how childhood trauma is about more than mental health challenges later on. We'll talk about the greater issues surrounding adverse childhood experiences when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. 2 decades ago, some social scientists published some landmark research that uncovered some previously undiscovered insights into stressors that affect developing minds. The Adverse Childhood Experiences Study quantified the traumas that affected 17,000 adult patients years before.
But the more recent work by a pediatrician is connecting the dots between those traumatic experiences and physical ailments that are all too common among children in this country, issues like ADHD, diabetes, asthma, and others. Nadine Burke-Harris is the founder and CEO of the Center for Youth Wellness in San Francisco. She's also the author of the new book, The Deepest Well. She joined us recently by phone. It is a pleasure to speak with you.
It is an honor to talk with you.
It is an honor to talk with you as well. I wanted to start by maybe getting a working definition of a particular term that is key to this conversation. You write about three classes of stress, or stress responses, I think. How do we distinguish between the three, the healthy and unhealthy forms of stress?
When we talk about our stress response, the medical science shows us that there are kind of three ways that we classify our stress response: positive stress response, tolerable stress response, and the toxic stress response. And positive stress response is normal. It's a healthy part of growth and development, and it's probably the thing that gets most of us up in the morning and make sure that we, you know, pay our bills and do all the things that we're supposed to do. And that is a brief activation of our stress response that is really time-limited, and it's in response to your kind of typical day-to-day stressors. And these things go back to normal after a short period of time. So if you imagine, for example, a child starting at a new preschool or a daycare, that would be a bit of an anxiety-producing experience for the child. They get their body activates stress hormones, and then with healthy relationships, it comes back to normal, right? The tolerable stress response happens in our bodies in response to more significant stressors, things potentially like a natural disaster or the death of a loved one. And these can lead to more prolonged activation of our body's biological stress response. And in terms of the release of stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol, but with the right protective buffering, with the right relationships from safe, stable, and nurturing adults, kids are able to recover, and that tolerable stress response can actually go back to baseline and doesn't cause long-term damage. The toxic stress response happens when kids are exposed to severe, chronic, or prolonged adversity. And what we see is long-term changes to our body's stress response system. And that leads to changes in brain structure and function, long-term changes to hormonal levels, changes to our immune system, and even the way our DNA is read and transcribed. And that could be as a result of things like abuse or neglect or growing up in a household where there is domestic violence or a parent is mentally ill or substance dependent.
Well, and these are all things that go under the category of adverse childhood experiences, the so-called ACE score, right?
That's exactly right. What the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and Kaiser Permanente found was that certain types of adverse experiences in childhood, which they called adverse childhood experiences, are associated with significantly increased risk for health problems, things like heart disease and cancer and stroke and diabetes. And we now understand that it's because of this prolonged toxic stress response that happens in our bodies.
Right. So realizing that you cover the subject in thousands of words in your book, how did the light bulb go off for you that the physical issues that you were seeing in your patients on a more or less daily basis as a pediatrician had quantifiable connections with the toxic stress that they were also experiencing?
For me, I grew up observing patterns in nature. My dad's a biochemist, and he, always was teaching me about the natural world and the science behind a lot of the patterns that we observe in the world.
Sounds like a really interesting childhood.
It was. It was actually. It was really fun, and in addition to that, you know, with my training in public health, when I was seeing patient after patient who were referred to me for lots of different problems, for behavioral problems, health problems, asthma, ADHD, but what I observed was this trend that my patients who often had the worst outcomes were also the ones who had some pretty significant exposures to adversity. And I wanted to understand the science behind that pattern. And that is what set me on a path to doing the research around how early adversity affects children's developing brains and bodies.
You mentioned things like obesity and ADHD and diabetes and asthma, and we see these things as endemic or epidemic proportions in especially impoverished parts of not just inner cities, but rural areas as well. Have we gotten to the point where we're approaching them in the right way yet, or is part of what you're writing about the needing the light bulb to go off for everyone else?
One of the big missed opportunities right now is that, as a society, we are not systematically addressing childhood adversity as a root cause of many of the things that we're struggling with in our society, right? Both health problems and some of our society's biggest social problems as well. One of the things I talk about in The Deepest Well is when we understand the impact of early adversity on brain development and how an overactive stress response interferes with learning, we understand that adverse childhood experiences are not only at the root of a health crisis in America, they're also at the root of America's education crisis. And that's something that right now we're all dealing with the downstream effects, but we're not getting to the root. And that is what I hope to open people's eyes to a bit in The Deepest Well, is understand we can be much more effective when we understand what's the mechanism, what's the root cause, and then understand how do we interrupt that process, because that's what the science shows us.
This is an epidemic of toxic stress every bit as much as it's an epidemic of asthma or ADHD.
That's exactly right.
You know, so the landmark ACEs study happened, 20 years ago. Why has it taken so long for this part of science to catch up?
Well, it is 20 years this year. It's very exciting. This is one thing that we see in science. Sometimes it takes time to translate these findings. But the big piece was that a lot of folks didn't understand the biology of the toxic stress response. What we knew was there was an association between early adversity and poor health outcomes. But in the past 20 years, one of the things that has really filled in is a much deeper understanding about how is it that our stress response becomes overactive, and then how does an overactive stress response damage our health? And that allows us to look at solutions, right? Things like the importance of recognizing symptoms of toxic stress to begin with and responding with reducing the dose of adversity and enhancing the ability of the caregiver to be a buffer to that stress.
This also has implications. I mean, we're talking, you know, you're talking about very young patients, but toxic stress can have implications that last throughout a person's life, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And one of the most important things about this work is a recognition that it doesn't just go away, right? That there are many adults in this world that are living with an overactive stress response. And that impacts, our health, it impacts how we parent, it impacts how we engage at work. And simply for adults, just doing your own assessment of adverse childhood experiences and looking at whether or not you might have an overactive stress response. And then, you know, thinking about solutions. What are the things that actually help to fight the toxic stress response? Things like regular exercise, good nutrition, and doing things like mental health, you know, good old-fashioned mental health, that is still a really important intervention. Healthy relationships. These are things that help to buffer the stress response and improve health.
Are there bigger public policy implications for this work, too?
Huge. Huge.
Maybe yes. That was an obvious question.
Because, right now we are spending almost $3 trillion a year on healthcare, and 75% of that is for treatment of chronic disease. Having an adverse childhood experience score of 4 or more dramatically increases the risk for 7 out of 10 of the leading causes of death in the United States. We are spending this money on healthcare. We're spending this money on management of, addiction. We're spending this money on dealing with the opioid crisis. We're spending, all of these different things, and we haven't tackled early adversity as a root cause of that. And so what we need is the infrastructure and the resources to be able to move from being reactive to doing some prevention. And that's why one of the most important things I believe that we can do right now is to make sure that every pediatrician in America is screening for adverse childhood experiences just as part of a routine physical exam. That simple change could make a dramatic difference in the lives and the outcomes of so many children.
Is PTSD a subset of this or a synonym for this?
That's a great question, and that's research that still needs to happen. We're beginning to tease that out a little bit more right now, but one of the important pieces about understanding the toxic stress response is that it's really a developmental injury, right? When kids are exposed to high doses of adversity, it changes their developmental trajectory. It changes the way their immune system develops, their brain develops, their hormonal systems develop, and even the way their DNA is read and transcribed. And when we look at PTSD, typically we don't think about that being associated with DNA changes, right? And so there's a lot more research that has to happen to understand, you know, what falls into that PTSD category. Toxic stress is clearly associated with this overactivity of the stress response and these changes in our different body systems.
At what point is the body resilient enough? How old do you have to be before we stop worrying about the impact that toxic stress has on your genetic makeup?
Well, what the science shows is that the earlier we begin our interventions, the most important thing for helping kids heal is early detection and early intervention. And that's why universal screening is so important. But in terms of, you know, at what point are folks no longer susceptible? That's another thing that we're still learning more about. We know that when we look at brain development, we know that high rates of neuroplasticity are happening until folks are about 25 years old, right? So we know that the brain is still organizing and structuring until about age 25. And really, a lot of the changes to brain development are a core piece of toxic stress. But understanding whether or not, kind of when folks are totally out of the woods, is a question that we're still answering.
Is there also a cyclical effect of this, that some of the, you know, some of the stress can lead to long-term health consequences, which itself can lead to its own toxic stress?
Absolutely. There is a cyclical effect to it in the sense that when folks have an overactive stress response, A, they're more likely to have health problems that can lead to more problems later on. Like, we know that for folks who have high doses of adversity, they have higher risk of also having mental health and behavioral problems. And this has to do with the changes in the brain around the reward center of the brain. And so folks are, because of these changes in the brain, in part, folks are also more likely to engage in high-risk behavior, for example, right? And we know that high-risk behavior also puts health at risk, but it also makes folks more at greater risk for experiencing another trauma, right? And so this kind of cycle that happens, not just because of behaviors folks choose to do, but also because of the changes to brain structure and function, is really critical for us to understand and try to interrupt that cycle.
Would you say, are you optimistic about the trajectory we're on at this point?
Absolutely. Oh, my goodness. If there's one thing about this science, it's just that it's so hopeful. Because when we understand the biology of what's going on, we can be much more targeted in developing interventions. And it feels to me like we are on the verge of a public health revolution in, number one, getting the word out, raising awareness about this issue so that individuals can, you know, put their own oxygen masks on, look at their own adverse childhood experiences score, and understand how they can be part of breaking this intergenerational cycle and not handing down adverse childhood experiences to their children. And we're on a medical frontier. We're learning more than we ever have before, and we're understanding that there are interventions that help to heal a dysregulated stress response and reduce the impact of toxic stress. And that's what's so exciting to me.
Well, Nadine Burke-Harris, thank you so much for your time and your insights and your work.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure.
Nadine Burke Harris is a pediatrician and founder and CEO of the Center for Youth Wellness in San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood. Her new book is called The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. We first spoke with her before an appearance at Marquette University last month.
One more break, and then a Milwaukee native helps chronicle the origins of one of the most important theater works of the 20th century. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For people coming of age today, the portrayal of gay and lesbian characters in popular culture does not seem unusual. But chronologically speaking, it was not that long ago that things were very different. One of the key works that changed things was Tony Kushner's 1993 play, or really two plays, called Angels in America. It won Tony Awards and the Pulitzer Prize and was later adapted into a star-studded and acclaimed HBO presentation.
But the creation story of Angels in America, which is an angry, passionate, sprawling meditation on gay life at the height of the AIDS crisis, is its own fascinating story. And its appearance on stage also changed theater itself and gave the world a new vocabulary with which to discuss being gay in America.
Milwaukee native Dan Coyce and his co-author Isaac Butler bring together interviews with Kushner and hundreds of other people involved in the production of Angels in America in a new book called The World Only Spins Forward. Coyce joins us via Skype from Northern Virginia ahead of an appearance this week in Milwaukee. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
So this project actually started with an article you and your co-author Isaac Butler did for Slate, right?
Yeah, I'm an editor at Slate, and at the time I was the culture editor, which meant it was a lot easier to greenlight sort of high-intensity, odd projects about plays than it might be at most magazines. But we had the idea to celebrate what was then the 25th anniversary of the play's very first performance, of Angels in America's very first performance in San Francisco in 1991. And we knew that the play itself was sort of epic in scale and scope, and we had a hunch that its origin story was similarly epic, and thought it would be fun to tell that story and specifically to get the people involved in it to tell the story themselves in oral history form. And we were right. The tale was epic, so epic, in fact, that it could not be contained in a mere 15,000-word Slate cover story, and we had to go bigger.
Well, and so it turned into an epic project for the two of you.
Yeah, so we spent about a year interviewing about 250 actors, writers, directors, critics, historians, cultural commentators, everyone we could find who had a hand in the creation or the perpetuation of Angels in America, as well as hours of interviews with Tony Kushner, the author of Angels in America. And then we assembled that into this book, which attempts to not only tell the complete story of this play, but to situate it in the greater cultural context of the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s, of the Reagan Revolution of the 1980s, and then how those things have both evolved into the present day, with AIDS now as a chronic but manageable disease for most people, and the Reagan Revolution as a chronic and unmanageable disease still striking America.
It's interesting. It reads very much like a documentary. I mean, you can really imagine jumping from one interview to the next. Why was oral history such an appropriate way to tell the story as opposed to maybe a more conventional narrative, but just as epic a narrative?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is, very simply, we knew we were going to be talking to some of the best, talkers on earth, people who love to argue and debate and hold forth. Someone like Tony Kushner, famously, you ask him a question and you're going to get like a 20-minute disquisition in response. And at the end of it, you'll be like, I think you answered my question and also 100 other questions. And we were also talking to George Wolfe, the director of the original Broadway production, and Meryl Streep, who's a great talker, and Lin-Manuel Miranda, who's a great talker. We just knew that we were going to be talking to all these people who were so great on their feet and who were so interesting to hear. And the idea of putting ourselves between our readers and those voices seem crazy. You know, why not let them tell the story since they are the ones who know the story the best? It's a dialectic. It's about voices arguing with each other about politics and love and life and romance and AIDS and gay life and being in the closet or coming out of the closet. And so it also seemed like we could honor that and bring that spirit to this work about the creation of that play by making our play a chorus of voices in argument with each other.
And I think you actually just answered my next question. But, you know, we should make the point that you and Isaac did these interviews over time. They are portrayed as these conversations or debates or what have you. But that's one of the values you added to this. You kind of create the dialogue. You create the structure of the conversation.
Right. That's a trick of editing. You know, we talked to someone in June who has one version of the story of how Angels in America became two plays instead of one. Then we talk to someone else in August who has a completely different version of that story. Then we talk to someone in October who has a third different version of that story. And when you put those stories next to each other, you realize that those three worldviews on this very tiny little subject are in opposition to each other. And in telling them together, you create a much broader picture of how those early years of Angels are remembered differently depending on who has what agenda, how they remember differently based on who has a stake in that decision and who has a stake in not telling who really had that decision. And you get the sense of how conflict-filled even the tiniest decisions were in the early years of that play.
Well, and so when you talk to somebody in June and then you talk to somebody in October who contradicts or varies somewhat from the what the person in June says, do you have to go back to the person in June and say, hey, person in October just said this?
No, not usually. I mean, the structure of the oral history is that you let people have their say, and then you use the contradictions to highlight, the differences in those storytelling. It was something like that. You know, we did our best to fact check it, which is to say we would, you know, go against the published record. We would ask Tony, what's your memory of this? But in the end, we weren't, for a lot of these discrepancies, we weren't able to tease apart who really knew the truth. And people stood by their stories.
One of the messages from these interviews is that there really doesn't seem to be anyone in the orbit of this work who was not profoundly affected by it.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't hard to get people to tell these stories to us. It wasn't like we approached people and they, you know, 2 weeks later wrote us back with a lukewarm, oh, I guess I sort of remember Angels in America. This was a signal moment in people's lives, in their political lives, in their artistic lives, and their personal lives. And so people were hungry to tell these stories because the play and the experience of creating it or having a hand in creating it so defined their lives and careers for decades to come. Whether it was people who, you know, like Tony himself or like Oscar Eustace, the co-director of the play in Los Angeles in 1992, or George Wolfe, the director of the play on Broadway, whether they were people whose careers were made by this production and this play, or it was people who were in an early workshop and then got fired and never put their hands on that play again, those people had equal stakes, they felt, in the creation of this signature artistic event of the 20th and 21st century, and it had similar impact on both of their lives.
You know, there are going to be people who see the revival of this on Broadway or maybe read this book or any of the other, attention being paid to it, who might think of this period as almost ancient history, which is difficult to believe for any of us Gen Xers in the crowd. But can you give us some perspective, you know, on the before here? What was the depiction of gays in popular culture? How are they represented in popular culture before Angels in America?
They weren't really represented. If they were represented, it was either as clowns, right, as sort of funny gay sidekicks, or as monsters, like the great example is the killer in Silence of the Lambs. That is the way that gay culture sort of made its way into the mainstream at that point. Emily Nussbaum, the TV critic for The New Yorker, talks in our book about how hungry she and her friends were for examples of queer representation in media. And so to have this play, which burst onto the scene in 1992 and 1993. I can't overstate the extent to which this play was everywhere when it was on Broadway. It was in the pop press. and the cultural press and even the highbrow intellectual press. They were writing stories about it in the New York Review of Books. To have this play, which centered the American experience, the American story on gay men and their lives, which made an argument that you can't understand American history, 20th century American history, without understanding the crucial role that gay men play at the center of it, was huge, was revolutionary.
Well, and it's so interesting because as we're having this conversation, there's a feature on Tony Kushner in today's New York Times, or at least online in today's New York Times, and they did a piece on your book as well. But you make the point, or other people make the point as you speak with them, that really the AIDS crisis wasn't even portrayed in the New York Times for years.
Oh, yeah. There was you couldn't use the word gay in the New York Times until the late 80s or early 90s. And though the New York Times famously ran the first mainstream media report on what was then known, just thought of as a gay cancer, but which later became known as AIDS, they, like most mainstream media, did a very poor job of covering the epidemic in the 1980s. And they mostly covered it as exclusively a gay disease and one that had no impact on what they believed to be mainstream culture. And, you know, first Larry Kramer's play, The Normal Heart, in the mid-80s, and then Tony's play, Angels in America, were, among many other things, pushbacks against what they viewed as a marginalization of this crisis that was destroying their culture from the bottom up in the mainstream media.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I use the term ancient history to some people, but in some ways, the circumstances out of which Angels in America arose are not even necessarily, I mean, you know, Donald Trump is elected as you're writing this book, which, you know, there's this, I guess, cosmic connection between Roy Cohn and Donald Trump, is there not?
I would not even call it a cosmic. I would call it a very nitty-gritty, earthy connection, which is that Roy Cohn was Donald Trump's mentor. You know, Roy Cohn is famously a character in the play Angels in America, is being played by Nathan Lane on Broadway in this revival that's opening soon. Roy Cohn was a closeted gay man. He died of AIDS. But before he got really sick, he was a power broker in the 1980s New York legal and cultural scenes. Donald Trump learned at his feet. He learned how to intimidate and bully a judge or the justice system. He learned to be an aggressive litigator, to threaten and cajole and go to court if you have to get the things that you want. And then when Roy Cohn became sick and it became clear that Roy Cohn was gay, the Donald Trump of the mid-80s ditched him and left him in the dirt and went on to his own career. When we started this project, Barack Obama was president and the moral arc of history was moving forever in a more progressive direction, and Donald Trump's candidacy was a joke. And then when we finished the book, Donald Trump was president, and it seemed like a lot of the battles that we thought had been won, that many of us thought had been won in the 90s and the 2000s, were in fact still being fought, still being, in the way that Roy Cohn would prefer us to think about it, litigated. And so that was the terrain, those difficult 80s, and a terrain in which gay people were being marginalized and killed, and progressive culture felt as if it was lost. That was the terrain that Angels in America sprang out of. That was what the world was like when Tony Kushner was writing it. And so to have this book come out in a world that seems surprisingly similar to that culture of the late 80s and early 90s, it was a real shock, but one that I think makes the book a more potent document for a lot of readers.
The arc here is from Tony Kushner to Jared Kushner, apparently.
Right, right. Yeah, Tony told us that Jared Kushner really screws up his Google News results.
You write not only, or the you spoke with people not only about the development of the stage version, but the screen version as well. And I gather at some point this was going to be a Robert Altman film?
Yeah, that's one of the amazing things we turned up researching this. It just blew our minds. Robert Altman optioned Angels in America right at the sort of peak of his career resurrection, right when The Player and Shortcuts were hitting the scene and reminding everyone what an incredible American artist Robert Altman was. He optioned Angels in America, and the idea was to make it into two movies about 2 to 2.5 hours each that would maybe even be released maybe a month apart from each other. Fine Line was going to do them, the same studio that had worked with him on so many of his of the movies that made his name, that brought his name back into the limelight in the early 90s. And he stuck with that project for many years and tried to make it happen, but never really could. In many ways, I mourn the loss of what surely would have been a completely bananas two movie experience, you know, and with probably with Pacino as Roy Cohn, just as he later played the character in 2003. But Altman had all these ideas for sort of his stable of actors that he was using in the early 90s to populate this play.
But undoubtedly brought a lot of people to that play that otherwise would never have been exposed to the stage version.
Oh, yeah. And it's, and you know, one lesson of what we heard from studio executives about this is that if Altman had made that version, it wouldn't have been seen by that many people and it would have lost a huge amount of money. Whereas the HBO version was widely seen. It was a, you know, a huge hit for HBO. It won a zillion Emmys. And the star power in that movie did indeed bring this history and this play and these stories to a population in their homes that never would have gone out to see it in a theater.
How did your own feelings about Angels in America evolve over the time you were doing this project?
I would say both broadly and narrowly. Broadly, I became more and more convinced of the case that we sort of set out to make, but that I felt a little unsure of at the beginning, which is that you can make a real case for Angels in America as the defining work of American art of the last 30 years, that it contains all the sort of arcs of our culture over these last 30 years, and that it was a soothsaying work in its day and now serves both as a kind of crystal ball of our future and a very focused look at our past and where we have been. I've become more and more convinced of that over time. Narrowly, I've become more convinced of something that if you had told, you know, college age me who first encountered these plays, I never would have believed, which is the play, you know, is split into two parts. Part one, Millennium Approaches, and part two, Perestroika. I become more convinced that Perestroika, in all its messiness and its unfinishedness, is a greater work of art, even if as a play, it can be a lot more difficult to sit through, especially if you end up in a bad production of it. That play will never be finished. Tony Kushner, though I'm sure he would hate to tell you about this, is still working on rewrites right now for the production on Broadway that's supposed to open in just like a week. You know, he's never going to be finished with that play, despite the number of times he told us and told other people, oh yeah, the play's done and I'm never touching it again. And I kind of love that about Perestroika. I love that it's a great unfinished work about the way that humanity is itself a great unfinished work.
Dan Coyce, it's a great work that you have done in compiling all this really interesting stuff, and thank you so much for sharing some of it with us.
Thanks a lot.
Milwaukee native Dan Coyce is an editor at Slate, and he's the co-author, along with Isaac Butler, of The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America.
Coyce will talk about the book and the play Thursday evening at an event at UWM's Curtin Hall that also features readings from some of the interviews in the book performed by local writers and actors. There is more information at WUWM.com.
And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, as it always is. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.